Cisco wants Wall Street to think of it as a growth company with exposure to fast-growing sectors such as software and hybrid work. That was the pitch to investors on Wednesday afternoon at Cisco's key investor day. Joining us for more is Cisco Chairman and CEO Chuck Robbins. Chuck, always nice to see you. Thanks for taking some time this morning here. My question to you is I think, pretty simple here. Do you think Wall Street is misunderstanding Cisco?
Well, Brian, first of all, it's good to be with you, as always. And I think, look, what we tried to do yesterday was basically remind them of what we told them in 2017 and that we actually delivered on our execution there to give them more visibility to this software transformation that we've been driving. When I took over, we had $3.4 billion in subscription software at the end of last fiscal year, which ended in July. We were roughly around $12 billion, so we've made a lot of progress. And also to just highlight that so many of our customers right now are on the front end of multi-year investment cycles around, to your point, hybrid work, hybrid cloud, the 5G infrastructure build-out, the progress we've made in selling into the infrastructure of the major cloud providers, and you know, edge, IoT, all of these we believe are going to be tailwinds for some time to come.
So do you think the street, Chuck, is just too focused on legacy Cisco?
Well, I think what we're trying to do is give them the metrics that they actually need to actually think about our valuation in the proper way. And so I don't blame them. I think we just have to make sure we continue to give them the information they need so they understand the transformation. We, you know, Scott yesterday announced that we were going to be giving them new metrics around percentage of subscriptions in our revenue, ARR, our RPO metrics. I mean, and all of these are metrics that software companies tend to provide. So I think as we do that over time and as we execute against what we told them we were going to do, much like we did against 2017, I think we'll be fine.
Let's talk some really interesting numbers at Investor Day, Chuck. One that stood out to me among many, currently your total addressable market, the way you see it, $260 billion. But looking out longer term, you see it reaching $900 billion. How do you close that gap?
Well, I think if you look at what our customers are doing, again, around the areas that we just talked about, this pandemic has really highlighted the incredible need for technology modernization, the need to have your infrastructure ready for this adaptable hybrid work model of the future, to have your infrastructure more ready for the hybrid cloud world where you have applications in public cloud, private cloud, SaaS applications, the distributed world we're going to see with all the employees and apps and data everywhere. And so I think that as you look at these trends and the fact that we're in the early innings of the 5G transition, we're in the early innings of this 400 gig architectural transition that we see in the cloud providers moving into the enterprise, you know, we just think there's a lot of opportunity for us. And we're really focused on trying to get the technology and the outcomes that our customers are trying to achieve as fast as we possibly can.
Yeah, a large piece of that pie that you talked about yesterday, $500 billion market potential, future of work and automation. I know you have the WebEx platform, but where else do you play in that market?
Well, when you think about the future of work, it's much broader than just WebEx. I mean, it's meetings and hybrid work for sure, but it's video devices, it's new network infrastructure to accommodate. Think of the home office now as a small branch, and you have to look at it and be able to deal with it in the same way you would a small branch. You need to manage traffic coming out of the home and going to the cloud. You need to be able to do troubleshooting in your employees' homes in ways that you never had to before. The security architecture that you need for hybrid work is completely different as we go forward. As our employees come back to the offices, there's technology that we can use to ensure the safety around social distancing and other aspects that we want to make sure we're focused on as they come back. So it's a huge market, and IDC actually laid the numbers out, and we think there's a lot of opportunity for us, and that's what we've seen. We saw in Q4 our product order growth was up 31%, the highest we've seen in a decade, and a lot of that was around these categories that make up hybrid work.
Yeah, so I'm hearing what appears to be a different Cisco starting to materialize. You know, given your, I would say, sharpened focus on software and recurring revenue, are there businesses inside the Cisco portfolio that no longer fit?
Well, Brian, we've always been looking at our portfolio, and we've looked at where we needed to divest businesses. We've done a lot of that since I became CEO, where we where we need to add new capabilities to our platform. But a lot of our software businesses are connected to, you know, cloud management of a network piece of hardware. So there's a lot of integration. And if you just think about what I just described in hybrid work, the architecture that's required across security, across collaboration, across networking, across sort of analytics and insights and troubleshooting, I mean, all of those need to be brought together so that our customers, again, they want the outcome. They don't want to be systems integrators. They just want you to help them get to where they need to be. So we're actually really pleased with the portfolio we have, and we think we're probably in the best shape we've been in a very long time.
There was a little disappointment, Chuck, I would say, amongst analysts on the longer-term outlook. So 5 to 7% longer-term revenue growth over the next four fiscal quarters. You're looking for something similar in terms of earnings per share. Now, the street was looking for about 9%. Is there something holding the business right now on why you wouldn't be growing quicker?
Well, there's two things we talked about. First is that if you look at that TAM that we discussed, if you look at these major transitions that are occurring, we want to be able to invest for profitable growth. That's our plan. And I'll give you an example. Five years ago, we started investing in new silicon capabilities that led us to build new systems that enabled us to insert into the cloud provider's infrastructure, which we hadn't participated in for forever. And so it proves when we invest, we can actually deliver technology that can drive growth. The second piece of it is for some period into the future, we are experiencing higher cost in our supply chain. So our gross margins are a little pressured by the COGS increases that we see right now, and that's going to be with us for a period of time. So we thought it was prudent from both an investment area and some of the pressure we see in the supply chain to make sure that we guide it appropriately, and that's what led us to the 5-7 and 5-7.
Are you able
to push
through?
We would expect, Brian, over time, as a supply chain improves, and obviously software is a bigger percentage of our revenue, we would expect that to get better.
Have you been able to push through price increases on this environment, just given the inflation you are seeing?
We have done some targeted price increases, but really only at the areas where we've felt them. We're not trying to leverage price increases to drive revenue growth or anything like that. We're really just trying to pass through. And our customers largely understand it right now because, candidly, most of them, if they're in any sort of business that has a supply chain, they're doing the same thing. And so we have been able to push some through.
Chuck, what's your read on the global economy here? Since we last spoke, I would say global growth has ticked down a noticeable amount in the U.S. and China. You also do business, in China and Europe. What's your read on the global economy?
I think that, you know, it's healthy, but obviously the comparisons are going to become tougher as we move forward. So I think you got to just look at the math and make sure you don't get you don't read too much into a mathematical change. But from what we see right now, the spending from our customers is very balanced. It's balanced across Asia, it's balanced across Europe, in the United States, and it's balanced across our customer segments, enterprise, public sector, service providers, as well as our commercial or our mid-size and small customers down. So from what we see, it seems to be very balanced on a global basis right now.
All right, we'll leave it there. Cisco Chairman and CEO Chuck Robbins, always appreciate the time. Have a great week and enjoy that football this weekend.
Let's chat electric vehicles, because we've been hearing a lot about the competition in that space. And of course, we've heard some interesting headlines from China talking about consolidation in the space in general. But today, we are seeing one EV maker catch quite a big boost off some positive notes. In an analyst note talking about Lucid, shares are up more than 5% today as Bank of America put out a $30 price target on that stock, citing pretty big reasons to be optimistic. And for more on that, happy to welcome in the analyst behind the report, Bank of America's John Murphy joins us right now. And John, it caught a lot of eyes because you compared Lucid to one name you might not, their Ferrari, and Tesla, of course, their peer in the EV side. Talk to me about what has you so excited about Lucid in a sea of companies.
Well, Zach, thanks for having me. You know, I think as we look at these early stage EV auto manufacturers like Lucid, you kind of have to pick some operating metrics and look at the management team to understand what's going on at the companies, because their ability to turn revenue and cash flow positive is a number of years out. And I think when we look at Lucid, we look at Peter Rawlinson, founder and CEO. who was the chief engineer on the Tesla Model S. So that's a pretty good proof point that you've got somebody that's battle-tested in one of the biggest EV vehicles that's out there in the market right now. But in addition to that, you've got a company that supplies battery technology sole-sourced to Formula E. So that's kind of why we look at it versus Ferrari, is Ferrari provides a lot of powertrains to F1 race teams. So there's kind of a parallel there. I also think that as you know, Lucid is starting out, they're starting out at the high end with their Dream Edition vehicles that are in the $175,000 plus or minus range. We'll grind down over time, you know, to some degree, but still stay at luxury price points that are probably at $70,000 plus. So I think when you look at this, you've got the combination of, you know, some real good know-how from the chief engineer of the Model S at Tesla, great technology, and then a focus on you know, powertrain tech as well as the luxury market. So it's why you have this combination that's really powerful, I think, that's somewhat similar between a combination of Tesla and Ferrari.
Yeah, let's talk more about, I guess, the combination comparison, I should say, to Tesla on a valuation basis, right? Because that's another thing where, you know, the company came public via SPAC. You can have your thoughts on SPACs, but when you talk about maybe how this company should be valued, what do you see when you stack it up against those comps?
Well, I think when you look at it versus the three other, you know, SPAC or startup names that we cover in the EV space right now, I think the progression of the plant and the management might be a little bit further along. Some of those companies are doing reasonably well. Certainly wouldn't count out Fisker or maybe even the other two. We're certainly not as favorable on those stocks at the moment, but it's certainly, you know, certainly early days, you know, for those companies. But I think as we look at Lucid and think about the race to one full plant, so as a dumb auto analyst, you always think about 250,000 units as being one full plant. I think that Lucid is likely to get there a year or two or maybe 3 years earlier than Tesla did. So I think if we look back at the valuation of Tesla in its early days, it's somewhat, you know, appropriate and somewhat of a good guide stick. But what we're doing right now in this 3x EV to sales to get to our $30 price objective on our 2025 estimates is basically simply taking close to the average of the three other EV startup companies as well as Tesla. And that's kind of how we're arriving at that. If you look at that, you know, Tesla right now on 2025, it's trading almost 10 times EV to sales. So it's an extreme discount to where Tesla is trading right now, an average of where things are right now in the EV space. And, you know, something that's a little bit more aggressive than where Tesla was at this point of its, you know, maturation curve. But I think pretty appropriate given the validity of the business model at Lucid that we see so far.
All right, so that's the bull case there on Lucid. But when you back up, and I guess, you know, this will also be kind of more impressive for them to reach any kind of milestone faster than Tesla. Of course, they're kind of building on the backs of the giant there in kind of the progress being made on the EV side. But importantly, they are dealing with a few different other things market-wide that you highlighted in a new note as well, which is, of course, chips impacting supply. A lot of people maybe might like to debate the demand side of EVs. My dad bought a Tesla not too long ago. I saw kind of the demand there, even in Texas. But on the supply side, how big of an impact is that on the whole EV market as they kind of battle with other companies out there to secure chips to keep pumping out cars?
So there's a lot of gradations to the semis chip shortage. I think for the majority of the industry, it's a much bigger issue. When we look at a company like Lucid, you know, at the moment, they're going to do, you know, a few hundred to maybe 1,000 units this year as they start up production in Arizona. We have them doing about 20,000 units next year. So in the grand scheme of the demand for chips, I don't think, or the supply of chips, I don't think that's going to really derail the Lucid story itself. For the bigger manufacturers and the industry at large, it's a very significant issue, but it's not something that I think is going to really nick these startup EV companies at this point in the maturation curve. And hopefully, a year to 18 months out, we'll be through the bulk of this chip shortage, and the EV manufacturers, as well as the rest of the industry, will be through the muck, and hopefully we'll get a very good auto cycle off the back of that that will help and lift them all.
Yeah, lastly, that was pretty interesting in the note, kind of looking at kind of the dips down, still not returning to pre-COVID levels into Q4 of 2022. I mean, talk to me about why that's the timeline.
Well, I mean, what we're seeing right now is inventory has been worked down to almost record low levels, or, you know, lower levels than we've seen in 30 plus years. We're about 1 million units of inventory in absolute terms, just in the auto industry on dealer lots right now. Traditionally, normal is around 3 to 3.5 million units. So we're very low on inventory at the moment, and it just keeps getting tougher and tougher with different kinks in the supply chain, particularly around semis, but other places as well for the industry to ramp up production. So we don't think it's really until you get to mid next year, and even in the second half of 2022, you start catching up on production, and not even until 2023 that you start to get some level of normalization on inventory. So the industry is going to operate in total probably at much lower levels than anybody was expecting, and lower than most people are expecting even at the moment. And we'll see, you know, strong pricing on the new and used side of the business for the vehicles themselves, which will help automakers offset some of this volume pressure and help, you know, help profitability. It'll be a bigger problem for the suppliers because they're just getting lower volume, and pretty good for the dealers as well, as they're getting good gross margins off the vehicles. So different links in the value chain are being impacted differently, but you know, it's the toughest for the suppliers, okay for automakers, and the best for dealers at the moment.
Well, it's a very hot space right now. A lot of questions, a lot of interest from our viewers. So I appreciate you coming on, not only with two pretty good notes there in terms of detail, but also an interesting call there in one name particularly. John Murphy, Bank of America analyst. Thanks again for the time. In today's Crypto Corner, if you haven't been paying attention, there is a huge rush to capture the market in DeFi. As a lot of these protocols had been building on Ethereum, there has been an intense battle to get a lot of coders, developers, users shifting onto some other blockchains. And one that has been pretty active in trying to attract people to come to their platform is Avalanche. We've seen that token there rise more than 1,700% year to date. And today, they announced additional funding coming from Polychain and Three Arrows Capital, and a $230 million investment into the ecosystem getting built around Avalanche. And for more on that, happy to bring on the president of the group behind Avalanche, Ava Labs. It's President John Wu joins me once again. And John, it's been only a couple months, I think, since we chatted down in Miami at the Bitcoin conference there. But Avalanche's run has been pretty impressive here. And a lot of it has to do with the effort you put into attracting it. It was $180 million, I think you guys announced, with Avalanche Rush to attract a lot of people to shift over, you know, in building out what you guys are working on. But talk to me about the growth you've seen in that effort and the new raise announced today.
Well, Zach, first of all, it's great to see you again. And since the last time we spoke, I think it was BTC Miami in May or June, obviously a lot has happened. And we're very excited today to announce the $230 million raise for Avalanche. So Avalabs is the services and software team behind the protocol Avalanche. So Avalanche raised $230 million. Great supporters. As you know, the lead guys you mentioned are Polychain, Three Arrows, but there are others that's supported Avalanche in the past. I need to mention them as well. Dragonfly, Galaxy, A16, Initialized Capital, and many more. But I think it's a testament to all of our partners, VC partners, to the growth in utility on the Avalanche platform. This is why the raise was what it was, being one of the larger ones in recent memory for a protocol. It is so we could continue helping Avalanche with the trajectory that was already on an organic basis growing incredible. Since we spoke, I think in June, there's something close to like 400 or 500 projects and total of 900 since mainnet that the team has been looking at to try to vet and help out. And on top of that, the technology, I wish everyone can go and check out the bridge, how smooth that experience is.
Yeah.
So they can get assets over.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the things here too, right? And we talked about this a few months ago, is kind of these layer one protocols now getting a lot of things built on them. And a lot of it has to do with DeFi. We've seen some of those projects, Aave, I think, as well, kind of transitioning over to Avalanche and working with you guys. And the total value locked, right? This is one of those metrics that people look at in terms of activity, money flowing into these protocols by users and putting it on chain, has skyrocketed over the last few months for you guys too. So, I mean, talk to me about that in kind of what you're trying to build out.
Yep. This is, you know, your stuff. So that is one of the metrics a lot of people use as an indication of real utility in blockchain ecosystems. And if you think about layer ones, there's really only three or four that are live. Obviously, we know Ethereum. Then there's Avalanche, the fastest growing, I would argue, if you just look at the numbers and compare the different metrics and the growth rates. So what is happening is there are not just crypto native users, but also traditional users who are very, very excited and see the benefits of peer-to-peer finance and decentralized finance, where they can actually get good yield. This is not just individuals either. Institutions are doing this as well.
And we were talking about tokenizing all kinds of assets, right? And doing that on the Avalanche protocol. And obviously, if you're a believer in that kind of expanding, you would be a believer in the protocols that are winning and trying to attract people to tokenize whatever it is they want to tokenize. And I think a lot of the attention has been put on NFTs as of late, and we've seen that space explode. And a lot of that's built on the Ethereum blockchain, and that's produced pretty high gas fees when we're thinking about the transactions on that network, a lot of congestion. But you might not be a believer of NFTs, really. You know, you could say that might be a bubble, and eventually it's not going to be providing the growth anymore. So, I mean, you guys have a new partnership with Tops to build NFTs on Avalanche. Talk to me about that and how important it is maybe to drive some NFT action off Ethereum to what you guys are doing.
Super exciting. And you're right. Another great use case is NFTs. We're seeing in the ecosystem around blockchain, literally hundreds of millions of dollars of transactions per day. With Tops, we're super excited because we're going to be creating NFT, you know, digital collectibles for various licenses they have. And most recently, I think you have a picture up, is Major League Baseball, a sport that is very dear to me personally. I can't wait to see all the NFTs and continue to collect them over time, especially into the actual playoffs. But what Avalanche created in the NFT world right now is unique. Most of these platforms and protocols, when they have a NFT product, it's usually one or the other. What I mean is it's either abstracting away the entire blockchain experience, fiat on, centralized custody, fiat off, or it's the other end of the spectrum, very crypto native. It is crypto on, crypto off, self-custody, harder to use, more DIY, but others like that. This platform that the software company Avalaz behind Avalanche has created actually allows both at the choice of the user. If you want a self-custody, great. If you want to have a centralized custodian for you, you can do that too. Different prices for different people, do it yourself versus more service, up to you. So now, as far as I know, there's not too many offerings like that right now.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, that adoption cycle has taken some time. You know, it's mostly been people who understand the crypto market, and so it takes a while. You know, I've never had more people asking me how to get a MetaMask set up and how to start using this stuff, but it's happening in real time. And John, I mean, you know, I saw on another network you might have been asked three times about Ray Dalio's comments when it comes to Bitcoin and regulations here, but there are regulatory questions, I suppose, to get into about, you know, what DeFi is doing here. But it seems like it's so far down the line because they're focusing in on more centralized institutions right now and what's going on. But when you look at maybe regulations in regards to DeFi, as it's getting built out and as more of these things kind of shift from being centralized organizations, I mean, what to you maybe are some of those regulatory risks that might still be there for investors who are looking at not just Avalanche, but really all kinds of DeFi projects right now?
Yeah. So in terms of regulation for DeFi or crypto, and I don't know what's in the regulator's mind, but if I read the words from Gensler and others, they want to mitigate risk for fraud, for money laundering, and they want more investor protection. I think everyone in the blockchain space agrees that that should happen. The key, though, is that they have some sort of collaboration and talk with blockchain developers and blockchain users and give some certainty. Because if you look at other jurisdictions, Japan, Singapore, rules are a lot more clear. Switzerland, rules are kind of clear. EU is about to cement some rules as well. And we do not want to lose talent, innovation, and projects overseas because our rules are uncertain. So I think certainty is what everyone is looking for. Philosophically, everyone believes investor protection rights, mitigation of fraud, mitigation of risk of money laundering. Those are all good things. So hopefully we can work towards that and have a good dialogue.
Yeah, and not lock out some of that progress that's being made here. It's exciting to watch all this and happy to have you join us again today to kind of discuss a lot of what you're working on, seeing a lot of money flow into it and a lot of money raised. But interesting to see some of that getting put to use here in new use cases for everybody out there. But Ava Labs President John Wu, appreciate you coming on again, man. Hope to chat soon. Be well.
Ford Motor Company is taking the next step in bringing its own electric truck to consumers. Pre-production models of the Ford F-150 Lightning have started rolling off the line at a plant in Michigan. Ford's President of Americas and International Markets Group, Kumar Galhotra, is here now with some details for us. So, Kumar, first off, congratulations. The electric F-150 Lightning hasn't even gone on sale yet. Yet demand is so hot, the company is already expanding production. Tell us exactly what's happening at that Michigan plant today and the investment that Ford is making there.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. We introduced this vehicle at this very site about a year ago and started taking reservations. And the demand, the reservations, have far outstripped what we were originally planning on building. So, seeing that kind of interest in the vehicle, we immediately started working on breaking constraints, both in our factory right here at the Rouge and in our supply base. So today we're happy to announce that we're investing $250 million incremental dollars and creating 450 incremental jobs in southeastern Michigan over three different plants in this area. To meet that demand, so our capacity now will be more than 80,000 units out of this plant, all F-150 Lightnings.
That is definitely a sizable investment to try to meet this demand. When can we expect the truck to hit dealerships? And also, give us an idea for what pre-orders are like right now.
So. We price the product very, very aggressively. It starts at under $40,000. It is a lot of fun to drive. And, you know, as all of our trucks, it's built for tough. And it's extremely capable. And you can also power your house with it in case you expect a power failure of some kind. The truck we're building, I'm in the plant right now. We're building pre-production vehicles as I speak. And it should start getting to our dealerships around spring of next year.
And when you say that, you say it's a starting price of $140,000, or is that it sort of, you know, really blitzed out, Kumar?
No, starting price of under $40,000, $39,900 something.
Right. Okay. I'm sorry. I misheard you, and I don't know if other folks did too, but that sounds a lot better and a lot more accessible for folks. So starting at just under $40,000. Talk to me about some of the challenges. I mean, you're trying to get this truck out there during a pandemic. You're dealing with a global chip shortage and supply chain hiccups. What have you been experiencing while trying to produce this truck?
Yeah. So this year for overall production has been very challenging, not just for us, for the entire industry, because of the wafer shortage that's led to the chip shortage. So we have a unbelievable manufacturing and materials planning and logistics team that is working 24/7 to get as many wafers and chips as we can, and then more importantly, deploy them in the products that our customers really truly need. So that is one challenge you mentioned. The second challenge, of course, unfortunately, COVID has continued, and sometimes the two intersect. For example, there's a chip supplier in Malaysia that didn't experience the chip shortage per se, but was hit with a substantial COVID outbreak. So when the two intersect, it causes more disruptions for us. But we're managing through it very well, to the best of our ability. Third quarter production is going to be better than second quarter. And in the middle of that mix, getting the vehicles that our customers really want to our customers, we're also protecting our launches like this one. This is a very important launch for us, and we are doing everything possible to get the right chips to this vehicle line so that we can keep the launch on track for spring of this year.
You know, a lot of people question whether or not truck buyers, you know, would trade in their gas-powered workhorse, if you will, for an electric pickup that needs to be plugged in every day. By the looks of things, by the looks of the investment that Ford is making, you're pretty confident that the answer there is yes, they want an electric pickup truck.
Absolutely. So we know our truck customers very, very well. By the way, we had similar skepticism from a lot of folks when we launched the EcoBoost. People were telling us that truck customers only like V8, so the EcoBoost may not be successful. Yet it was incredibly successful. And I think we're repeating a similar transformation here. Truck customers are very, very savvy. They know the electric motors can provide great torque, which they value. And as far as charging goes, it is actually quite simple. You know, you simply go home and plug it in. So it actually takes less time to do so than to fill up your tank. And you leave your house every morning with a quote-unquote full tank. By that I mean a fully charged battery. And if you are going on a longer trip, it can get up to 80% charge within, you know, at one of the high-speed chargers in less than 20 minutes. So it's extremely convenient. And I would argue that the proof of the is in the pudding, because the reservation numbers are so strong for us that ever since we launched it, our team has been working on continuously breaking constraints so that we can satisfy the demand. So, yeah, the truck customers are ready for the F-150 Lightning.
Yeah, the last number I saw was 150,000 pre-orders. Is that accurate?
150,000 reservations, yes. So we've been taking reservations. And at some point, when we get closer to production, the customers take that reservation and convert it into orders. And we expect a majority of those reservations to convert into orders. And we followed a very similar reservation system, both for our Bronco launch and for our Mustang Mach-E launch as well.
Yeah, there's a lot to look forward to here in certainly the fourth quarter, but in the spring of next year when this truck and the Bronco are going to hit dealerships. Kumar Galhotra, Ford's President of Americas and International Markets Group, thanks so much for being with us. Welcome back. eBay has launched a rare opportunity for sneakerheads. It's called eBay's Inside Drop, and it will celebrate and reward eBay's community of sellers, both new and old, with some of the rarest, most incredible friends and family sneakers on the planet. Joining us now to learn more about this drop event is sneaker expert and longtime eBay seller Jacques Slade, and of course, our resident sneakerhead, Reggie Wade. Good to have you here, guys. Jacques, with all the sneaker platforms out there, why do you think eBay sets it apart?
I think one of the key things about eBay that sets it apart is the fact that they have no seller fees. On a lot of the other platforms, they actually charge you to sell. And eBay, being an OG in the game, recognizes the value in the community. And they took away those seller fees if you're selling a sneaker over $100.
Jacques, great to see you again, my brother. Now, what can...
Good to see you too, Reggie.
Tell us about... What are some of the pairs that are up for grabs in this drop?
I think the most popular pair is probably going to be the Fragment Air Jordan 1 that came out about 5 or 6 years ago. It's a collaboration with Fragment Design and Jordan Brand. And that sneaker, as a friends and family sneaker, goes for about $8,000, maybe a little more, depending on where you get it from.
And we all know something that dismays many sneakerheads is bots. And we all have to deal with them when we're trying to get these shoes on release day. And it's taken away some of the joy out of people. I've known people that said, you know, I'm leaving the sneaker game because of this. Do you think the larger companies like the Nikes and Adidas of the world are doing a good job at trying to root them out?
I think they are doing a good job of trying to root them out. It's a very difficult process. It's like a moving target. Like a lot of these people that make bots, they're constantly refining and constantly improving the things that they're doing for their systems. And so it makes it harder for these brands to keep up. But I think the brands know how this is affecting the community, and they're getting a lot of pushback from the community. So it's in their best interest to try their best to fix things and get rid of those bots as much as possible. So you see a lot more raffles happening. Nike has their draw on the sneakers app. Adidas has confirmed on their confirmed app. So these brands, they're definitely taking the steps to make it possible so that the consumer can actually get the shoes and that they're not dealing with the bots.
Speaking, do you think that's why it's a better option to go on secondary sites like eBay so that you don't have to deal with them?
Yeah, that's one of the benefits of going onto the secondary market directly. You don't have to deal with the bots. You know the sneaker that you want. If you're on eBay, you can just simply do a search and you can find that sneaker right away. And then you can place a bid or make an offer on that sneaker right then and there. You don't have to worry about the bots and the shoes selling out because you have them there with the inventory that's right on eBay.
How has it been working with eBay? Because they're not a shoe marketplace. They're a marketplace for many things. But how have the sneaker people on the site interacted with you? And do you really feel that it's truly run by sneakerheads?
Luckily, I've been inside some of the meetings with eBay, and I do know that they have some sneakerheads on the staff that are working. So that definitely made me feel comfortable in establishing a relationship with them and working with them as a creative consultant than a sneakerhead. And I do believe that sneakerheads do have a better chance of getting what they want on eBay. There's other platforms out there, but when it comes to someone that I think is really taking a look into the community and making themselves a part of the community, I don't see anyone doing it quite like eBay is doing it.
Dax, how do you think the pandemic has changed the way that the sneaker community interacts with each other? Because I remember before the pandemic, going to shows and going to stores, being able to touch these things, these sneakers, but that's changed. Do you think it's changed for the better or for the worse?
I don't want to say it's for the better or for the worse. I think it's just forced this community and really everyone to just look at things differently and interact with each other differently. A lot of these conversations are happening on Zoom and things like that. So sneakerheads are interacting a lot more online versus in person. The sneakerhead community is a very communal group. People used to line up together. Some of the best friends that I have, I've met in the world of sneakers, either standing in line or at an event or something like that. So there's a very communal nature to the world of sneakers. For the pandemic, in that situation, obviously that communal aspect isn't there, but it has allowed us to get together digitally. So you see events happening online or through Instagram or talking on Twitter or talking on YouTube. So you have these platforms that have really risen up, and that's kind of become the communal place. That's where we have conversation. Doing live chats with the sneaker consumer is a big thing now. So I'll do live chats on my channel where I'm talking to the consumer directly because we can't really meet with them in person anymore. So yes, it has changed some aspects of the sneaker community, but it's just allowed us to find other avenues to have those same conversations and to share those same passions in different ways.
Jack, do you think the bigger brands are listening more to the sneaker community? Because I remember back in the day, they just gave us what they felt we wanted, but it looks like they're starting to listen to the sneakerheads a little bit more. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we, as a collective, we all have a voice. And one of the biggest changes I think we've seen in the sneaker world is the influence of women. Women have always been a part of the sneaker culture, but their voices haven't always been heard. And I think over the last 2, maybe 3 years, you've seen a huge influx of women and into the conversation of sneakers, and women in positions at brands and decision being a decision maker at a brand, and brands pushing the women forward and having them out there in the public to know, like, this is a larger community. Yes, there's a ton of guys in it, but there's a huge community of women that have contributed to the sneaker world in ways that I can't even imagine. And now we're really starting to see those, the things that they've been doing to this community and how they're helping to push the community forward as well.
Jackson, I'll put you on the spot. What sneaker made you a sneakerhead?
Oh my gosh, the sneaker that made me a sneakerhead. There's a couple. And it's not the main one, I would say. It's not probably the most popular sneaker, but it's the Converse Chuck Taylor. I wanted to be a musician as a kid, and it seemed like every time I watched TV, all the cool musicians had on like the low top Converse Chuck Taylors that were all beat up. And so I think that's the shoe that kind of turned me into a sneakerhead, because I wanted to be cool like those musicians. And in order to be cool like a musician, you know, you obviously got to have the same shoes they have on. So that's where it all started for me.
It all starts from the feet up, right? Jacques Wade.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And Reggie Wade, thanks, guys. I learned a lot. And look, it's a huge industry, $21 billion sneaker industry, but $2 billion resale industry. So there's a lot at stake. Guys, thanks again.
Investors are also keeping a close eye on crypto. We want to take a look at Bitcoin because Bitcoin, under a bit of pressure today, still holding above 47,000 right now. But we want to get over to Danny Ramiro, who's joined by two special guests. Danny?
Thanks, Shauna. In the world of cryptocurrency, FTX US, the US arm of the world's biggest crypto exchanges, has partnered with Shark Tank investor Kevin O'Leary as an official ambassador. And joining us with more on this partnership is Kevin O'Leary himself and Brett Harrison, president of FTX US. Thanks so much, guys, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And Kevin, let's start with your deal with FTX. What was your thought process there and why FTX US? And does it solve your compliance problems?
Yes, it does. I don't endorse products or services that I don't actually use. I eat my own cooking. I think that's important. I have been trying to solve this compliance issue with my own internal compliance department, my external auditors, and of course, the regulators, for quite some time now. The truth about crypto and the opportunity as well is that it really hasn't yet been adopted by large institutions the way people think. And the number one reason for that is not lack of interest. They want to allocate Bitcoin, Ethereum, et cetera, and many other tokens, coins, change, whatever, but they don't have the infrastructure to report into their systems. It's that simple. When you buy a stock or a bond, let's say you're running a $1 billion mandate and you want to allocate 10% into a portfolio of crypto, that's $100 million. You don't download an app on your phone and do that. You have to have it built into the infrastructure so that it marks to market by the second, like a stock or bond does. Your compliance department can see your position every second. At the end of the day, reports it to your external auditors. They sign off on your statements, and it goes off to the regulator. There is no infrastructure for that yet. So FTX is the largest and has the most invested in building out what I call institutional grade compliance. So I've been able to do that. I've been able to structure a situation where I can manage now my own portfolio on an FTX, and I'm starting to build up from a 3% weighting up to 7% in my operating company by the end of the year, and I'm going to be using FTX to do it. So I feel very comfortable endorsing this product for what it does, provides as a service, and how it can help someone like me and thousands of other institutional players solve for this compliance problem. It boils down to, I get the best service, I get access, all that, but it's compliant. And that is what I have to care about first.
And was the deal paid in dollars or in crypto? And I guess what does, I know you mentioned a little bit about your portfolio. So what does that really look like now?
Well, actually, I didn't want to be paid in dollars. I want the smartest guys on the trading desk at FTX to tell me what I should own. It's that simple, because they get to look at a lot of different products from all around the world. I want crypto. I want to have an allocation of around 7%. And I don't want it to be just in Bitcoin. That's not diversified enough. So I'm building a portfolio with them now, deciding what I want to hold. And I've decided going forward, I'm going to disclose and be transparent on the percentage ownerships of what I own. And I think that's very important, because one of the things I get concerned about is I have millions of followers. I don't want people to think that I'm buying things and then promoting them. I'm going to disclose what I own and why I own it, why I think the merits of each of these positions are, on a monthly basis. I'm really, really interested in DeFi. I think it's disruptive. It's going to be much less friction in the costs of all kinds of services. You know, just my FX costs of the largest market in the world is currency. When I want to buy a Swiss stock or a European stock in euro or British stock in British pounds, I've got a trader in front of me clipping me for bips every time, both ways. I detest them. Those words are too strong. I don't like those guys, and I want to get rid of them. And I'm hopeful over time, they add no value. They add no value, and that's just one use case of what the future holds for decentralized finance. And I think FTX is at the fore of all that. And why wouldn't I want to be associated with a player like that? It makes total sense for me. And for me, it's to be that dialogue with the institutions that I talk to every day about how I'm tiptoeing into crypto.
Yeah, and Brett, onto that point, you know, I know that you're planning on entering, you know, crypto derivatives and, you know, expanding your user base. Where is the company on that?
Absolutely. So as you may know, recently FTX US, which is currently a regulated spot cryptocurrency exchange, We trade around $200 million a day of spot crypto volume on the exchange. We recently acquired LedgerX, which is a CFTC-regulated derivatives exchange and clearinghouse, which is going to give us the ability, in collaboration with LedgerX and also in collaboration with the CFTC, who regulates derivatives in the U.S., the ability to offer crypto futures, crypto options, and other kinds of futures and options to our customer base. And we're really excited about this because, of course, crypto is immensely popular, but not many people know that more than half of all crypto-related volume globally trades in derivative products like futures. And what we want to do is bring that volume onshore onto the US within the regulatory envelope of the CFTC in a way that's available easily and safely, reliably, and in a compliant fashion to institutions and to retail customers.
And to that point, I mean, are you concerned of any of these regulatory crackdowns, especially that have occurred with DeFi?
You know, at FTX US, we have found through our many different conversations with regulators, the SEC, the CFTC, that their door is open and they want us to walk in through the front door and talk with them about what we're doing, how we can work with them to be compliant with the regulations that they want to create and have already created in many circumstances, to bring these products, again, in a safe, reliable way to consumers in the US. And through those conversations, we found actually they are quite open-minded. I think that there's this misconception that the regulatory agencies in Washington just want to clamp down on all innovation in crypto. And it's just not true. What they want people to do is to work with them openly and collaboratively to make this happen. So at FTX, we're not concerned. We're very excited about these ongoing discussions that we're having with the SEC and with the CFTC.
And Kevin, you know, what is your thought process in terms of the infrastructure bill, the taxation, the regulatory debate that's going on? What do you see happening?
I'm actually very pleased that the regulator is getting far more involved. We've obviously had a bad press in the last couple of weeks regarding their role with some of the players in the industry. But the truth is, innovation is being created through decentralized finance. They know that. The U.S. should lead that. They should pioneer it. They should lead it. They should invest in it. That's not lost on the regulator. The best analogy I've used for this is I love to watch Sunday football. I watch every game. I go into my man cave and I watch it. Those players can't play unless they know the rules. They have to know the rules. There's so many people that want to play but don't know the rules yet. And it's the job of the regulator to provide those rules and the rule book. And they're going to do that. And so I'm very, very pleased at the innovation that's been coming. I know we're going to get it right. The amount of buying, you got to look at it from the upside. If all of a sudden the rule book was published and the regulator made the rules up from NFT through to derivatives, to futures, to coins, to chains, and all that stuff was settled, then all of a sudden you would have trillions of dollars of buying coming into this market. And that would be great for every participant and great for competition and great for services. And maybe I can get rid of those FX traders while we're at it. So, you know, the way I look at it is this is all good. And just because there's friction and a little volatility and some positioning, it's not true that the industry wants to go to war with the regulator. It's far from that. It's like Brett said, everybody wants to talk to them and find out what the rule book is so we can play ball.
Totally agree. This is such a positive sign that this debate's happening in Washington right now. It's definitely shown us that the senators on the floor, they want to be educated about this. They want to craft legislation that helps encourage innovation in the space and responsibility. You know, we believe that, you know, crypto exchanges like FTX US should be able to report taxes to the government, and that's to the IRS, and that's totally reasonable and normal. We want to make sure that we craft this legislation such that it encourages innovation for players in the crypto space and in the DeFi world.
Well, such a great conversation. Thank you so much, Kevin and Brett, for joining us.